Previously on MageCast.
It attempts to tell you it's a game telling you about your life.
Hundreds of different combinations. You could do an all-summoner party, an all-oracle party, or...
Whistle Dixie. Oh, there he did it on the spot.
Write that down. Subtext of dynamism.
Really hit a good pace.
Ba, 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 do, 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 ba.
So let's see. Well, what's that? You know what? I remember your bippity boppity for last time.
and not feel like you're playing some kind of polygonal mess, right?
Put your passion and value into it and make it valuable for the customer where they want it.
And it's MageCast. Magic is real.
And people have to see that there is something to learn from video games.
What's your new wife's name?
Charizard.
Those characters aren't funny.
What do I do? What do I play first? What do I need to understand?
How much does a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle weigh?
It's pointless to think about it and sad.
And then the screen went, boop.
That game is freaking perfect.
It is just a symbolic thing of a change in direction in your life.
Keep those spirits flying high and let your soul drink deep.
Which is a really odd thing to have to think about when you're 11 years old.
Someone goes in the bank and they're like, Black Manta took everything.
He's so melodramatic and so over the top.
He's not one of those, hey guys, welcome to my YouTube channel. Because it was something that these people just dreamt up together and really pursued this sort of passion project.
Is it the greatest game of all time? In my humble opinion, absolutely. 100%.
A lot of them have this idea of destiny or kind of the hero's journey.
This question of where lies the boundary between what is subjective preference and between what is objective.
Doll, the Link dolls that he can get, or the, you know, the pee bags.
Sell your cars that you have in your garage.
I think, oh yeah, completely. If somebody's still bringing up a game from 1997 to make a joke, God. And enough people get that joke, that is a tip of the hat.
There was nothing at all like it.
To advance throughout the different screens. Now the concept remains the same, it just becomes a more
beautifully elegant and simple story.
That story, I think so many people deal with the post-traumatic stress of dealing with this type of corporate work.
Even if you weren't like a super, like, I'm going to be the best in the world and I want to win and beat everybody.
It's just a sad robot throwing itself into a lava pit to make a bridge for you. It's kind of like...
a sad robot.
This is MageCast Season 2. That's right, we're back and as middling as ever, and I decided we ought to kick off the new year and the new season with the worst possible game imaginable, to many at least. For this episode, I'll be chatting with TB, aka Teacher Bloke 85, instructor and collector, about Zelda The Wand of Gamelon for Philips CD-i, oh no. I was reminded why I enjoy podcasting, though, after having a bit of a break, but diving back in and finding myself enthralled with the conversation. So thanks for tuning in once more, and now let the show begin. Oh, hang on, I nearly forgot that I must needs announce the winner of our MageCast giveaway for the launch of Season 2. The winner of a well-read merch shirt of their own choosing is Sanity Crypto, the lucky number. Thank you to all who participated in this giveaway, and look out for more throughout the year. The giveaway was sponsored by TeePublic, who also hosts our merch store, which you can check out by visiting the link in the description. Thanks very much, and now we can start the episode. All the way from the jewel of the North Atlantic comes my very special guest for this inaugural episode of MageCast Season 2. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sitting down with TB, a.k.a. Teacher Bloke 85. How are you doing today, sir?
Very well, thanks. How about you?
I am doing great on this fine, sunny Southern California December morning.
Oh, sun in December, sun in January. It's always rain here.
Is it always raining? Well, I miss the rain. It snowed here recently, which is unusual considering I'm in the desert. But yeah. we enjoy the sun most of the time. So this episode, we're going to be talking about a favorite of many folks, a favorite franchise, that is, a favorite series, what have you. The Legend of Zelda is beloved to many across the world. Many millions love The Legend of Zelda, love these games. You hear about Ocarina of Time, Wind Waker, Can you believe I'm drawing a blank on Zelda titles off the cuff? But we're not going to talk about any of those games, actually. We're going to talk about a game that I don't know if I've ever met anybody that loves it, actually. We're going to talk about Zelda, the Wand of Gamelon. Gamelon, that's the correct pronunciation, right?
It could be anything at this point. I'm Gamelon, Gamelon.
Gamelon. Let's call it Gamelion, because that sounds very elegant. The Wand of
Gamelion. I think we'll go with that.
Okay, so we're talking about the Wand of Gamelion. We waffled a little bit on coming up with a title for this episode, but I think we had some interesting ideas. I originally was just going to call it My Boy, because that's the meme that I know from these games, but then you informed me, delightedly you informed me, that comes from Faces of Evil, not Wand of Gamelon, which are two different games, and we'll talk about that here in a minute.
Which I didn't realize at first, because I haven't played Faces of Evil yet. I've got it, but I've only played the Wand of Gamelion.
That's not on the top of your to playlist? Are you kidding?
I think I'm going to use this podcast to decide by the end of it whether I should go and play Faces of Evil or not.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm sure that there'll be other people listening who will make the same choice. If you can find a CDI, that is. Another title we were coming up with was another meme, which is, I wonder what's for dinner, which is in Gamelon, correct?
Right in the intro. He gets on a boat, old King Harkinian, and says, fetch my boat, I wonder what's for dinner.
Because those thoughts naturally follow each other,
of course.
A couple other title ideas that we had, Phillips Does What Nintendo Shouldn't, which is quite funny. Gouge Your CDIs Out,
that's great.
The Zelda, oh, you know what, but I mean, you could use that for Hotel Mario, so The Zelda That Broke My Heart Container. Well, wonderful.
I was proud of this,
This one I chuckled. This is yours right here. I chuckled. Gamelon, more like Gamel Off. that's
as you can tell, awesome. We were struggling for titles.
We were struggling. One of the most enjoyable parts of Mage Casting, to me, is coming up with these ridiculous titles.
I love it.
Especially as they pertain to, yeah, it's fun, as they pertain to the specific game. I think we'll go with The Wretched of Zelda instead of The Legend of Zelda, The Wretched of Zelda.
Sorry, I think that's perfectly appropriate, because the title of this one doesn't have The Legend of before Zelda. It's just Zelda. So we'll put in The Wretched.
The Wretched, there you go.
We'll provide The
Wretched. And that's R-E-T-C-H-I-N. Apostrophe, in case you're taking notes. Wretched of Zelda, okay, because it's nauseating, you get it? So this is the 39th episode of MageCast, The Wretched of Zelda. We're going to be talking about Zelda the Wand of Gamelion from 1993, which was developed by Animation Magic and published by Philips Interactive Media for the CDI. Here are a couple of mage facts on this game.
Okay, these games are what we got as a result of Nintendo's broken deal with Sony to develop the Nintendo PlayStation and their agreement with Philips to develop a SNES CD-ROM add-on. The idea was eventually scrapped, but Nintendo allowed Philips to use 5 characters for developing new games on the CDI.
That is an interesting bit of history that I didn't entirely know. So we all know about the Nintendo PlayStation. If you're listening and you're like, what the baloney is the Nintendo PlayStation? It was something that was at one point in history about to happen. Nintendo had a deal with Sony, and they were going to develop this this device that was going to have CD-ROM capability as well as cartridge playing capability, apparently. There is, interestingly, I saw Nintendo PlayStation in the news recently. I don't know if you saw this, TV. There's one going up for auction, a prototype Nintendo PlayStation.
No way.
Can you believe that? Now, no. Before you guys start thinking, well, I'm a collector, I'm going to get a Nintendo PlayStation for myself, the owner of the prototype refused an offer of $1.4 million.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's priceless. I mean, if it's the only one, I don't know how many prototypes there are or how many have been sold before. But the article said there's no precedent. The auction house was quoted as saying there's simply no precedent for pricing this device. So it could get quite expensive. And then at that point, you're looking at, you know, really wealthy collectors and museums that are going to
get
this thing. Yeah, so sorry if you were hoping to have a Nintendo PlayStation of your own sitting on your shelf. I mean, who knows if it could even play anything, right? But
that's true.
Probably not. Like, it could play CDs. You could listen to your favorite Backstreet Boys albums. But probably can't play any games. I don't know. Who knows? But anyway, that idea was eventually never came to fruition. Nintendo kind of did this shady thing where they had an agreement with Sony and an agreement with Philips at the same time. Philips and Sony didn't end up working out. Philips ended up doing their CDI and Nintendo, almost like a consolation prize, it seemed like. I'm sure there's technicalities there that I'm leaving out, but I wasn't there. And you know what? If you're listening to this, neither were you, so forget it. Here's the next Mage fact. This is one of three Zelda games for the CDI alongside Link, The Faces of Evil, and Zelda's Adventure. So of those, TB, you've played just Wand of Gamelon.
Yeah, I played Wand of Gamelon through to completion. I've got The Faces of Evil, checked that it worked, and thought, okay, that's for another time. Zelda's Adventure, I've only ever watched the Game Grumps play on YouTube, and it looks awful.
Yeah. I was going to say, actually, that's a good just little note to bring up. I think that these games can owe their infamy to YouTube culture.
Yes.
Probably very few people would know about them if not for a couple of the big YouTubers playing through them and having a horrifying ball with them. speaking of horror, I think The Faces of Evil is a horrifying title. There's something just dreadful about that title.
Yeah, it's got a horrifying world map with lots of large faces carved into a cliff. And I thought, this looks really creepy. Whereas Wand of Gamelon just has a world map and it's a peaceful looking island with a few castles. I'm like, I can live with this.
And Faces of Evil will give you... I think of Faces of Evil as those zombies in Redeads, I think they were called, in Ocarina of Time. The ones that would hug you. Right, yeah, scary stuff.
Yeah. The games are not official entries in the Legend of Zelda franchise, not canon.
Sleep well, my friends, knowing they are not canon. They're not official entries in the Legend of Zelda franchise.
Which is a shame in some ways, because it's Wand of Gamelon and I don't know about Face of Evil yet, but... they're the first times you see characters such as Impa in an actual game, whereas previously they've mentioned in the instruction manual. So, interesting.
That's interesting. Impa was mentioned in the first Zelda's manual.
Yeah.
But didn't appear in the game. That's interesting.
No, and in this one, she's there as a character and voiced.
And speaking of firsts as well, Wand of Gamelon marks the first time that Zelda herself was a playable protagonist.
Yes.
So, which is pretty unusual for, you know, to confuse people, I'm sure, too, because the game's called The Legend of Zelda. Lots of people would confuse Link with Zelda. I don't think that's so much true anymore, but late 80s, early 90s, there were certainly a lot of people who were like, oh, I love playing as Zelda while you're playing as Link.
It makes a nice change, especially since... Zelda herself slept out Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, so.
Yes. Now, here's a little tidbit. Apparently, when I was doing research on Zelda 2, I found out that sleeping Zelda at the beginning of Zelda 2 is not the Princess Zelda from the first game, but actually the original Princess Zelda on whom all future Zeldas were named.
Oh.
So that's kind of a an odd thing. And now, well, this isn't canon anyway, but I'd suppose then that wouldn't be the particular Zelda that we usually see in these. Certainly not the same Zelda in Ocarina of Time and all that sort of thing.
No, as if the continuity of all the Zelda games wasn't confusing enough anyway.
Yeah, you need a book to sort it all out. Do you have that book?
I don't.
Neither do I. Have you ever tried to sort out the timeline?
Oh, no.
Yeah. My brother asked me recently, because he was visiting and he decided he wanted to play Ocarina of Time for himself. So he's having fun with it. And then he's like, wait, why does Ganon look different here? And I was like, oh, boy. Well, it all started back in 1984. And then, yeah. Trying to explain the timeline is a challenge. I did the best. Yeah. I took poetic liberties now and then, but hey, it's a franchise we all enjoy. So yeah. To start off with a couple questions here. And by the way, if you want to ask a question on the episode, you can visit my Twitter profile at the Well-Read Mage. On Tuesdays, which is typically when I announce a new episode. Sometimes I announce them early. Sometimes I announce them later. You'll just have to suffer through it. But here's a question comment from yourself. And I wanted to raise that so that we kind of get the gist of this is widely considered to be one of the worst games ever made. So you said, any question other than, is this game really that bad? For which I've already prepared a response. Grinning emoji, thumbs up emoji. This is from I Am J Rock, who said, is it that bad? Like the exact question. Only asking because I never knew bad could ever refer to a Zelda game. Well, my friend, I Am J Rock, I'm sorry to tell you. You live in a universe in which there is three apparently horrible Zelda games. They're not canon. They're not, you know, official entries in the Legend of Zelda franchise, but they exist. And then yeah. Ape Jaunty said, yeah, it's terrible. So it is. But just to get that out of the way, I don't think what we're going to be doing in this episode is sort of making an argument for the intrinsic value of these games as entertainment products. But we're going to be discussing them as aloof game critics and talking about some of the context surrounding them. We'll talk a little bit here about the CDI itself. It's not the most familiar platform to people. But just to sort of reiterate, since we're in a season two episode of MageCast now, to reiterate, MageCast is kind of about these critical looks at these games. And we don't often discuss you know, how much fun it is and those sort of things. While that's at the heart, I think, of what playing a game is about and that level of enjoyment, I think that this show is more particularly about discussing the elements of how it works, why it works, should it work, does it work, and the context surrounding it in culture and hardware and history and so on. So that's what you can expect for this episode. But first of all, let's talk about the Philips CDI. So you're, I think, the only person I know who owns a Philips CDI. How'd you come into owning one of those?
Well, if I can go through my own history of playing games, I started off playing on my parents' Amstrad CPC, playing things like Chucky Egg, Manic Miner. Got an NES for something like my sixth birthday, I think it was, and then there was this period where the Super Nintendo had come out and I didn't have one, but my cousin did. And he used to bring it over to my house and show me, and I'd just be in awe of what the Super Nintendo could do. And he had Super Mario World and A Link to the Past, and I was absolutely in love with A Link to the Past. It is still my favorite game of all time. And when Christmas was rolling around that year, my parents took me to one of these high street electronics stores. I can't remember if it was Curry's or Dixon's, one of those. But we were in there and they were showing off the Super Nintendo and the Philips CDI. And my parents said to me, "Ooh, which one do you want for Christmas?" And the salesman came over, overheard the conversation, and he just said, "That Nintendo's for kids. The CDI is the future."
That guy. Is he still there, I wonder?
I hope not. I don't think he was there anymore. But I just want to go back in time
if he was, you should just slap that guy. Find him somehow. He's like an old man. He's like, "I don't remember that conversation." You're like, "You ruined my childhood."
Thankfully, I chose the Super Nintendo. And
Good.
Yeah, I've still got my beloved Super Nintendo to this day. In terms of actually owning a CDI, it was only a few years ago now when I stumbled across one in a market stall as I was on one of my retro game hunts. And I saw it and I thought, "Oh my God, a Philips CDI? Really?" I thought, "I've got to own this." And I spoke to the guy on the stall and he gave me a bit of a discount because it didn't come with a controller.
Hmm.
Now, it turned out it was harder to get a controller than it is to get a CDI because I scoured everywhere looking for a controller for this stupid thing and I couldn't get one anywhere. Eventually, the only way I could get a controller for this thing was to buy another CDI from eBay.
No. So you have two consoles and one controller?
I had two CDIs at one point. The one that I got from eBay came with the PowerPoint clicker controller and the gamepad controller, the one that actually looks like a Super Nintendo controller. And it turned out there are various different add-ons to the CDI. One of the things you can get is, I can't remember the actual name of it, some kind of video display card, which is kind of an upgrade that allows it to play FMV movies. And I needed that so that I could play Seventh Guest and other adventure games on the CDI. I thought, I'm having this good one that I've just got from eBay. I'm going to sell the old one that isn't particularly great, and I'm going to put in the PowerPoint clicker with it so that nobody ends up in the same situation that I did with a machine and no controller. So, yeah, at one point, I was the two CDI kid.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing. Looking at it here, this thing released in 1990, which is quite early for a CD-based optical disc video game console.
I was doing a bit of research on that, and one of the things that the guy in charge of Zelda, Wand of Gamelon, and Faces of Evil, it was a guy by the name of Dale Descheron, unfortunately passed away a few years back now, but I read an interview with him, and he said the CDI itself was meant to be released in 1988. But it kept getting put back, delayed, and didn't actually hit the market until after the whole buzz around it had died down. And then to get back into people buying this machine, they kind of rebranded it as a games console.
Wow. A lot of it was apparently educational entertainment.
Yeah, I do have a couple of
encyclopedias.
Yes. If you can imagine Encarta from back in the day. There's a lot of bits of software on it that are very similar to that. I actually own one that came in a bundle of games. It's called Dutch Masters of the 17th Century. And I put this in out of curiosity recently. It is a wonderfully curated journey through the art of Rembrandt and various other Dutch painters. And I'm sat there thinking, this is really, really fascinating, but this is what the CDI was originally for? It blew my mind.
That's interesting. Yeah, and in a pre-internet world, you would actually have some use for that sort of thing. This is a kind of machine that would never be released today at all.
No.
It just wouldn't have a use at all. But to put it in perspective, on its early date, the Super Nintendo didn't hit North America until 91, didn't come to the UK until 92. So in some regions, the CDI predated it. So yeah. It's interesting to me to think that here was a halvesies video game console that was released so early that used optical disc technology. So interesting. Now, what was the first game that you picked up for, or the first bit of software that you picked up for the CDI? Was it Wand of Gamelon?
I'm trying to remember now whether it was Wand of Gamelon, or at the time I was going through a phase where I was picking up console versions of PC games that I used to have and used to play that you can't get on any other format, and you know, they're kind of dead these days. And I picked up Seventh Guest, which is one of my favorite puzzle games of all time, and one called Little Devil, which I used to love playing on the PC, but can't find the disc, can't find it on any online web store. So as soon as I saw it was on a console on CDI, oh, I've got to get Little Devil. That was great. But it could have been that, and it was probably around the same time that I picked up Wand of Gamelon and Faces of Evil.
Hmm. And so a question that I think is probably buzzing in a few people's heads right now, and indeed a question that was echoed by a few people, such as Duct Tape Plays, who asked, we all love the dumb, wonderful YouTube videos made from the cutscenes, but is there actually a reason to play the Wand of Gamelon? It seems awful. So a question that I would put to you is, why, TB, why did you buy Wand of Gamelon?
Like I said earlier, I'm a huge, huge fan of Zelda. I love the series. A Link to the Past is my favorite game of all time. And it still surprises me that there's some Zelda games out there that, even though they're non-canon, they're just eluding my grasp. I mean, it seems strange that I'm over in the UK where Tingle's Rosie Rupee Land came out, and I still don't own a copy of that. I really should. But I think now the only...
You should.
I should. I think the only one that's evading my elusive grasp at the moment is Zelda's Adventure on the CDI. And I actually saw a copy of it, but I wasn't willing to pay £250 for it.
What?
Yeah.
That's almost like $400. Was that like $400, I think, of the currency?
Something like that, yeah.
That's a lot of money.
I'm not paying that. The most I've ever paid for a single video game was, and I'm ashamed to say this, somewhere in the region of £160. And that was Panzer Dragoon Saga.
Well, it's Panzer Dragoon Saga. I was going to say, that depends very much, sir, on which game it is.
Exactly, but, yes.
Yeah, if it's Panzer Dragoon Saga, you're going to expect to... That's yes. Like Suikoden 2, you're going to expect to pay a hefty price.
Exactly, and I did.
Yeah, yeah. Every time I see Chrono Trigger, favorite game of all time for me, I don't own it. You know, I don't have it physical.
No way.
No, I don't have it. I don't have it.
Oh my gosh.
I had it at one point. I think I told this story before. So in super brief, I had it and I gave it to a friend for his birthday. I haven't seen that friend in close to a decade now. So,
wow.
But I hope he likes it. Just like crying in my sleep. But yeah, so that's one I don't own. Now I have looked at prices now and then, but I'm not going to shell out, you know, it's too much money for it. So, but I like that you mentioned, what is it? Freshly picked Tingle's Rosie Rupee Land.
Yeah.
So that is a, in the West, as far as the West, that's a Europe exclusive.
I think it is. So regional exclusive mage over here. I'd better get a copy and play it, hadn't I?
I was going to say, this is your shtick. You're the really regional exclusive mage. So just in case you guys are listening, you don't know, TB is the regional exclusive mage. His thing on the Well-Read Mage is writing about regional exclusive games. And freshly picked Tingle's Rosie Rupee Land is just begging. I mean, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. This is horrifying stuff. Tingle is one of those characters, like, every time he appears, I'm like, I'm uncomfortable.
Yeah, as if the box art for that isn't uncomfortable enough, I imagine the game to
it's
be.
It's just like a guy
even
you'd
more
meet
so.
At, yeah, he's like a guy you'd meet at like a nerd con that's just like way over the top insane fan. So, yeah. I don't know, my empathy to all the Tingle fans out there. Anywho, so you picked up Wand of Gamelion, as a Zelda fan.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, that's cool. You're kind of collecting games that have the Zelda name on them. And that makes sense. Now, I think that there are probably a variety of reasons, personal reasons, why somebody would want to pick this game up. And I tried to think for me, why, if I owned a CDI, why would I want to pick this up? As a collector, there's that kind of, it has, you know, a collector's item value. There's, I think, also the historical aspect that I think is significant to my mind, at least. And maybe you can kind of share some thoughts on that here in a second. But, you know, like we mentioned, it's the first Zelda to have Princess Zelda as a playable character. First Zelda with voice acting, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was. Was it just after the animated series, the famous "Well, excuse me, princess" thing?
I, you know what? I'm not sure because I never really watched that. So now, this was released in North America in October 10, 1993, and Europe, December 25th, 1993, was a Christmas gift to the world.
Oh, no.
in Europe. Merry Christmas. But the Legend of Zelda.
Oh, the animated series was
1989. So this is, you could say maybe it's the first time that a video game Legend of Zelda had voice acting.
Yeah.
But we already had the gift to mankind, the Legend of Zelda cartoon, which, have you watched much of that?
I did when I was younger. I've only just recently discovered or rediscovered the joys of the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Yes!
Because we got the... I don't recall any of the live-action segments ever being on TV. I remember the cartoons. I remember the Super Mario cartoons. Yeah, I just don't remember any of these live-action bits.
Yeah, they rebranded it eventually, and they sucked out the live-action.
Yeah.
And then made it just the cartoons. And I think it was rebranded as something to do with the Super Mario Brothers 3, if I remember right, but I'm not sure. Yeah. So I loved the Super Mario Brothers Super Show as a kid. It in Hawaii, it aired at like 2 a.m. on Saturdays. So we would stay up super late to watch it. Yeah. Because it's Hawaii. Nobody cares. But like wake up for church the next morning. Like, but the Legend of Zelda cartoon, I never saw as a kid. So I only encountered it as an adult. And by then, I didn't have enough childlike wonder in me to stomach it. So I saw the intro a couple times. I was like, yep, not going to watch this. Can't do it. So there's only 13 episodes, looks like.
Yeah. And I think I'm going back into my childhood now. And the one thing I can remember is that the whole point of the show was just that the King of Hyrule wanted to build a water park and Ganon wouldn't let him. I don't know if that's true. I don't know whether my mind's mixing that up, but if that was the premise, then I want to watch it again.
Wow. And Link falls into like a moat or something like that, at the beginning.
Constantly. So,
they just they just loved splashing in water, I guess. Anyway, historical value, you know, this has got animated cutscenes. There's, I think, a lot of firsts for Wand of Gamelion. But what's your opinion on games as historical value? If we introduce phrases like preservation, games preservation.
Oh, I'm really, really big on preservation because there's so many games, like I was saying about Little Devil earlier, that if I ever did come across a copy of the disc, it probably wouldn't work in any modern PC. It'd probably say, what the heck is this, and spit it back out at me.
I had that exact experience when I found one of my favorite games from when I was younger, SimCity 2000. And I was like, yes. Whoa, cool. It was mixed in with a bunch of CDs that I had from the 90s. Mm. And so I throw that in my laptop, and my laptop just ejects it right back out. And I was like, okay. Meh. Put it back in, and the laptop spits it out again. I was like, okay. So it just does not want anything to do with this old CD-ROM game. Yeah. And I guess that, yeah, that's what is a difficult thing with some of these old PC games.
Which is why when I want to play SimCity 2000, I play it on the Super Nintendo.
There you go. I'm sure you can probably find it in browser or something like that these days.
Probably.
A lot of those old PC games are, yeah. I'm going to do that after this show now.
There's quite a few that are coming out on online platforms like Steam and GOG at the moment that are just so good to be able to play again. Did you see that GOG recently re-released the Blade Runner game? And I genuinely didn't think we'd ever see that game again. It was just so wrapped up in rights issues that I honestly never thought it would ever get re-released. And I think it was about a week ago it just popped up. Oh, Blade Runner now on GOG. Like, really? So that to me is preservation at its finest. But for me, preservation, it's got to be physical. If there's a physical version of a game, I will buy it. Mm. And... you know, just so that I can just walk into the other room, just pick a game off the shelf, plug it into my Super Nintendo and play it. Or just walk into there, put the CDI game in. Whereas, like we said, some PC games, even from 2000, 2001, they're not going to play on modern PCs. But I think for preserving games such as The Wand of Gamelon, now... some people would probably want to play this as a curiosity piece, especially having seen YouTube videos from, let's say, Game Grumps or Angry Video Game Nerd. You know, they're kind of popularizing these bad games and making people want to at least try them. And I think if it was going to be preserved, I think it would be a good idea if it was done by the fans. Because did you see a couple of years back... a bunch of fans remade Simon's Quest.
I heard of that, but I didn't see anything about it.
Apparently what they did there was streamlined the whole experience, changed some of the clues so that they actually made sense, and actually cut down the time that it takes to transition between daytime and nighttime. So when we get into discussion about The Wand of Gamelon, there's so many gripes that I had that I think if they were smoothed out, it would actually make for quite an interesting experience and one that would actually be a lot more playable for people these days to experience.
That's interesting. So fan remakes, one thing that I'm very interested in with preservation as a subject is supporting the re-releases of these games. So some of my favorite games that I played in the past 2 years have been collections that have been really wonderful collections. The Mega Man collections, great. The one of my favorites was the Capcom Beat 'em Up bundle. You had, I think it was two arcade games that had never been released on home console before that you could now play for the first time at home. The SNK 50th, I think it was 50th or 40th anniversary collection just had a ton of arcade and home port versions of a bunch of games. And those, I think, are wonderful opportunities to preserve these games. So something like, you know, those arcade games, you're not going to find. I mean, you think PC games are old PC games are hard to find. Old arcade games are like, unless you can find the cabinet, which even then, good luck purchasing it. Some cabinets are extremely expensive. And it's a dream of mine to own an arcade cabinet someday, but I'm not going to shell out $1,500 for one. No. So we'll see until somebody's like, do you just want this? I'll be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I came into this 37-inch CRT recently that I was on Facebook. I wanted to find a CRT for Christmas. You know, my wife asked me, what do you want? I was like, I want a tube TV. So that's how I said it too, because I'm a brat.
That's great.
And so I go over to this guy's house. He was getting rid of this, again, 37 inch tube TV. It's humongous. From 98 or 97, he said. And he's like, do you just want it, dude? I was like, sure. You were only wanting to get rid of it for $5. I mean, I have $5 in my pocket. And he's like, tell you what, if you can lift it, you can have it. And wow. So I tried to lift it by myself and I couldn't do it. He's like, just take it anyway, I'll help you get it in your car. I was like, oh, thank you. But yeah, it's in my room now and I'm not moving it again. It's being sold with the house because this thing is, it weighs more than I do probably. It's a lot of, it's pretty dang heavy. But wow. All that to say, all these old things, all these vintage products, there are a variety of ways to preserve them through fan remakes, through official remakes. It would be lovely if we could get, you know, like a CDI Triforce collection of Wand of Gamelon, Faces of Evil, Zelda's Adventure on Switch. If Nintendo released that, that would be wonderful. It would be a great opportunity for people to play these for the first time themselves. But those sorts of things, when they come out, please, folks, support those things. If you care about preservation, I think that's more than just caring about, you know, distribution of ROMs, then care about the re-releases of these products officially. And oftentimes you get some really neat bonuses in those collections, like interview clips and concept art and little tidbits of history and things like that, that to me personally, I think are just really valuable.
And the ability to rewind, which is a contentious feature at the moment.
Contentious feature. This is true. What was it? That guy who said, if you used the rewind feature, you did not beat the game by any stretch of the imagination. I like how he said beat and not completed. I wonder how conscious he was of that choice of words. Because it is obviously you completed the game. You reached the end of the game. In one sense, you did not play the game completely. Well, no, we're talking about the rewind feature, not cheats and jumps and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
it'd be like if you plugged a game.
Yeah, I actually really love that guy, Mike Matei from Cinemassacre. I think he's an absolute legend, and I don't think he was being too serious when he said it. I don't think he was expecting the backlash.
It is Twitter, so
yeah.
If somebody
just
famous,
being sarcastic.
Yeah, if somebody famous says something tongue in cheek, they're gonna get shellacked for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Just how it works. Yeah, you're not allowed to joke about. You're not allowed to joke about things like that on Twitter. But it made for some hilarious memery. People who responded like somebody. I think it was Rad Zero. Shout out to Rad Zero. Retweet if you agree. If you used the whistle warp in Super Mario Brothers 3, you did not, by any stretch of the imagination, complete the game. So yeah, it made for some funny things. But here's a question from Arcade Castle, who said, in a word, infamous, but many non-gamers' first exposure to the series via meme culture, perhaps more than any other Zelda games. And then here's sort of the crux of his questioning. Should one weigh all aspects of a game's impact when understanding it in a historical context? For review, analysis, how much weight should it be given? I think a lot of that we're kind of discussing here.
Yeah.
But let's home in on, just for the sake of reviewing now, because that's something that both of us do. But what should you weigh? Should you weigh all aspects when understanding a game's impact for the purpose of a review?
I think you've got to think about whether you're judging it by today's standards or 1993 standards. And there's two ways you can go about it. I mean, seeing the CDI and the Wand of Gamelon playing in that electronics store, I was just in awe of the animation. I was like, I've never seen that on a video game before. That's just like a cartoon. Whereas these days we look at the exact same cutscene and we think, yeah, right. But like I say, there's two ways you can view it. And I think, just as a side point there, if they were going to remake it or re-release it, it should come with kind of developer's commentary or something down the side as you're playing it, saying, well, this was done because of this, or we chose this because of this. I think that'd be amazing. But
that would be.
I think if we've got to look at it in some kind of historical context, the way that we should put on it is, if I take a quote from, again, the guy I was quoting earlier, Dale Dicheron, we did the best with what we had at the time. I think I paraphrased that a little bit, but if you think this is a company that's been given the Zelda assets or the ability to make a Zelda game, if not the assets, but they said, okay, what do you want us to do with it? And I believe Phillips responded and said, well, we don't want a top-down game. That's been done before. We want something that's going to show off our hardware. So it's, all right, then, side-scrolling it is. And when you're thinking about it like that, the weight that you should put on it is, it was great at the time. Mm-hmm. It was groundbreaking at the time. It was jaw-dropping. So yes. Do you review it in terms of 1993 or 2020? Who knows?
Yeah, I think that I love this discussion. I think that it really depends on what kind of a reviewer you are and how transparent you are about how you write your reviews. So something I've tried to make a point of for the past almost three years in February is that, you know, there are different kinds of reviews. There are consumer reports that sort of just report on, you know, whether it was fun or not. Did you have a good time? Did you not have a good time? There are analyses that sort of dig deeper into whether the mechanics work or not. There are critiques, which in my view sort of cover a wide range of things, literary critiques of the dialogue, the storytelling, questions about the game's architecture, those sort of things, which I contend are objective qualities as part of the craft of storytelling and the craft of designing games. We all know what's a bad story. We've all read bad books. But are they bad because we just didn't personally enjoy them, or are they bad because the craft of writing was failed there? Now, I wrote a book and published a book, so I know what bad books are. I know where, reading through my book, I can point out objectively, this is where I made a mistake in storytelling. This is where my craft needs to improve over time. And I think that that stretches across a wide range. That idea of craft stretches, you know, to acting and cinematography and music and so on and so forth. So yeah. I think that, all that to say, I think that there's a different kinds of reviews that people can write, and all of them are valid. I need to say that more often. All kinds of reviews are valid. All types of reviews are valid. You decide what kind of review you want to write. Now, at the Well-Read Mage, we do typically long-form critiques. We also do short-form reviews if the games are more suited to that. We also do first impressions, which is sort of like a review in like a nutshell, right? Just a couple hundred words. But my perspective in writing critiques and writing long-form reviews is I'm going to try and cover as many aspects of the game as possible. But I personally consider those elements within the context and limitations of the era. So should I hold against a Super Nintendo game the fact that it was released on the Super Nintendo when it had no capacity to be released on the PlayStation 4 because the PlayStation 4 was not invented yet? Another question then from the other side would be, you know, if I wasn't reviewing from a historical perspective, from a contemporaneous era, and from my modern vantage point, then actually I would expect that each year I would have to go back through my old reviews and start marking down scores, because as hardware and storytelling and the craft improves over time, that those elements from the past would become more and more obsolete, or would be seen in more and more of a light of a failure, right? Like you were saying with Zelda Wand of Gamelon, if you reviewed it then, you might have given high marks to its views or its visuals. But if you view it now from the perspective of modernity, then you might give it very low scores for its visuals. Now, I think to be fair to the Wand of Gamelon, if you're reviewing it, if you're critiquing it, you have to critique it from the perspective of its own era. So I agree with you there that, you know, there's no point in saying the Wand of Gamelon has terrible visuals if you hold it up to the PS4. But it's like that's like 20 years later, dude. That's ridiculous. That's like watching Citizen Kane and being like, the graphics were awful compared to Avengers Endgame. I was like, well, of course. That's almost kind of too obvious, right? But here's the thing, right? So somebody asked me before, it's like, well, how on earth do you put your mind in the era that this thing was released in, especially if you weren't even alive or if you were too young? I think that it's important to consider context, especially if you're critiquing and especially if you're putting scores down on games. I think that scores and critiquery should be comparative. So, for instance, if I'm critiquing the Wand of Gamelon, then I want to consider what do the visuals look like in comparison with other games that came out that same year and that came before it, either on the same device or on competitive devices, so that you kind of get, okay, was this like a huge explosion of amazingness when it came out, or was it something that you were kind of seeing in other pools at the time? I don't know why I said pools, but other groups at the time. I don't know, does that sort of make sense to you then?
Yeah. I think the one thing from around that time, I used to be an avid reader of Total magazine, which was purely Nintendo focused, and they gave a perfect score, 100%, to Super Mario 64. And at the time, I thought to myself, well, there's no need to make any more games then. If we've got the perfect game right there, what's the point in making more video games? So you've got to think about it in comparison with everything that came before, yes. But again, compare Super Mario 64 with, let's say, Super Mario Odyssey. There's one that instantly looks brighter than the other, even though I would say they're both just as much fun to play. But it's strange to think about scores.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And so here's the thing on top of Super Mario 64 is you could perhaps, if that was your perspective, you know, that it was the perfect game on the N64 at its time, compared to everything that was there, contemporary and before it. You could still say that Super Mario 64, if that's your perspective, was the perfect N64 game. But now you would have to admit that, okay, maybe there are other perfect Super Mario games, Super Mario Odyssey or something like that, so absolutely, that you're not necessarily saying, you're introducing or injecting modernity into something. It's tricky though, you know? Because over time we've come to see there's an element of reviewing, right? We tend to do reviews well after the fact. We don't often review games right at launch. There's just a matter of, you know, the price and the time that you have to do things. We've got other things going on in our lives, so we can't just like, you know, buy Death Stranding and play it for a week without doing anything else. I think that there's an element of a game has to sit and kind of have time for you to reflect on it, to really get a larger sense of accuracy. And I'm not saying that reviews at launch are inaccurate. Oh no, the controversy. all I'm saying is that when you consider something over time, and this is true for a variety of other forms of entertainment, books, there's a variety of books that were not considered successes when even the author was alive. And it wasn't until afterwards that they rediscovered, they were like, oh, you know, this is actually quite good. Same thing with music. Same thing with film. There are a bunch of films that when they first came out, they're like, ugh. But then over time, people were like, okay, so I can see where they were going with this. So I think that criticism, as a culture especially, has to have time to germinate and evolve, and has to have time to consider these things. So over time, it's fair to say, we'll use the Mario 64 example. Over time, it's fair to say that, okay, you know, at launch, this was a wonderful thing. It was perfect. It was, you know, everything we wanted in a Mario game. And then over time, you can kind of see, okay, so the camera issues, like for me, Super Mario 64, the camera controls can get a little clumsy and iffy and cumbersome. And some of the woes with the N64 controller itself. I'm not a fan of that particular controller. so that those things kind of come out over time, right?
Yeah, and I think the thing with Wand of Gamelon is that once you get past, or at the time, once you got past the initial, oh my gosh, that looks like a cartoon that I'd watch on TV, and actually started playing it, and I think that's where a lot of it falls down, or fell down at the time, and looking back on it now, and I'm thinking, yeah, people that played the game actually realized that it was very, very flashy, but it did a lot of things very, very badly compared to other games that were available at the same time on other platforms.
And that's perhaps what maybe contributed to its infamy today, right? It's like, in its time, you had the superficiality of the visuals and their impressiveness, and it looks like a cartoon. But then as those visuals age, and nothing ages worse than visuals in video games, you can really see that there's not much underneath once you pull off the veil of the visuals. One final note here on weight given, and then we'll get into story and talk a little bit about the premise, is I think that if you're using scores are kind of a slightly controversial, an iffy subject for some folks.
Yeah.
But I think if you're using scores need to be, or should be, sort of a summary of what you're saying. So they're just symbols that people use to summarize whether your symbol is yay or nay, green or red, 10 or 1. They're symbols that you use to summarize the gist of what you're saying in your review or your critique or what have you. Now, that said, I don't think personally that scores should be affected by something like historical value or collector's value or something like, well, actually, I'll leave it there. but those sorts of extraneous things. So I tend to try to consider, while I talk about the context of the game in terms of the culture, things like memes. Okay, that's a good example. The memery of Wand of Gamelon and Faces of Evil is quite strong, but I don't think that that is actually something to consider in the evaluation of the game in terms of your critique. I think it's something to mention, and you can mention, you know, it's funny, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think that a game should be a 10 instead of a 9. Just because it has memes made about it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, story premise. Question here from Gyromancy, spelt with 0. I've never played it, and now I'm curious what or where a Gamelon is. What is a Gamelion, sir? So you're the guy who played this game. This is where we're going to start asking you questions. What is this game about?
I have played it from start to finish, and I don't know what or where a Gamelon is either.
Oh, no.
What I can say is there is an item late on in the game that is the Wand of Gamelon from the title, and it's basically one of those items that is used to beat Ganon, and that's all you need to know. It's just a MacGuffin that plots the rest of the game. The premise of this game, I actually did a bit of research on this one a couple of days back, and something I read said that this game, Wand of Gamelon, is possibly a sequel to Faces of Evil, because one of the items that was quite prevalent in Faces of Evil is used again in this game, but not mentioned by name. I think it was the Book of something or other. Can't remember the name.
It sounds like a fantasy item.
Book of something or other. That's the one.
There you go. Real quick, if I could interject, evidently Gamelon is a region in which Wand of Gamelon takes place, as opposed to Korodai, which is where Faces of Evil takes place. So maybe Wand of Gamelon is the item that's named after the region?
Probably. I hadn't even registered that the place that I was exploring was the region of Gamelon. Incidentally, it was the Book of Korodai. So
there you go. There you go. So then, and that might be something that was mentioned in the manual. It might be something that's mentioned as an aside in the game. One thing that, you know, we've kind of seen with games of this age is there's a lot of kind of extraneous storytelling background stuff that is mentioned very slightly or is in the distant background and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I think the thing about this one is it starts off with that beautifully animated cutscene where the king comes in and says, my cousin, I think it is, Duke Onclet, is in trouble in, let's say, the land of Gamelon, it must be. I'm off to go and see if he's all right. If I'm not back in a month, Link, come and find me. A month goes by, no word from the king. So Link goes off to try and find the king and says to Zelda, if I'm not back in a month, come and find me. Another month passes, Zelda goes to find Link and her it goes on and on and on. That's the general premise of this one. The king and Link have gone missing. Zelda, here's the island. Go find them.
Wow. There you are. So it's Zelda's quest to go and find Link and the king. Every Mage Cast is a spoilers cast. I don't think that too many folks will be upset if we spoil Wand of Gamelon. But what happened to Link and the king? Were they captured by Ganon or some such?
Believe it or not, they were. The king was captured by Ganon. It's never explicitly stated what happened to Link, but there was one NPC that Zelda was talking to halfway through. I think it was Lady Alma, who speaks to Zelda and said, oh yes, I kissed him. And Zelda, you kissed him? It was very odd. But later on...
sounds like.
Oh, really? Definitely. But right at the end of the game, Lady Alma's mirror is smashed and Link comes out of it saying, hey, what did I miss? And said, nothing, we're just about to have a feast. Ha, ha, ha. The end. And...
Wow. So he was just stuck inside the mirror.
That's a much more interesting story.
One thing that I was wondering is it possible that when Link leaves, that's Faces of Evil and that's what he was doing the whole time? Does he end up in a mirror at the end of Faces of Evil for some reason?
Ooh, now you're making me want to play Faces of Evil and find out.
These games were developed simultaneously. Right, so
and released on the same day.
Yeah, so maybe there's some story overlap that takes place. Kind of reminds me of the old Choose Your Adventure kind of stories that there'd be different ones and different characters, and they overlap. Possible.
Yeah,
I don't know. I've not played any of them, but that's up to you to decide. And you know what? If you play Faces of Evil, we'll do a Faces of Evil podcast. Maybe the last podcast of the year. We should do Faces of Evil, and then we'll bookend 2020 with CDI Zelda for no reason at all.
I'm down with that.
All right, so let's get on here to gameplay. So I already knew that the story was going to be rubbish, right? It doesn't sound impressive at all. It sounds rather tedious, actually. But that's, perhaps to be expected. So I always held out, maybe the gameplay is really good. And I never heard anything about the gameplay at all. We got a question in that regard here from Sanity Crypto. Since the infamy of the CDI series is all most of us are familiar with, does it have any redeeming qualities or even novelties that we could appreciate? Or is it just a roaring dumpster fire for all eternity? So that's up to you to answer, sir. Is the gameplay at all worth writing home about?
Right. If I can take you through my experience with the very first level of this, this should give you a bit of an indication as to, what was it, roaring dumpster fire? Yeah.
Yes, please.
You start off in a region called Aru Ainu, or it opens up three areas to begin with. Aru Ainu is meant to be the first place you go. You're walking along what looks like a diagonal ledge, and you can't tell at first that it's a diagonal ledge because the way that it's presented as this 2D side-on thing, it's, the artwork there is beautiful. But it's very difficult at first to distinguish what's a platform and what isn't. And that's a running theme through the entire game. Is that a platform? No, I just fell through it to my death. Is that a platform? Well, that bit is, but that bit isn't. And that's where a lot of the frustration starts kicking in. Then added to that, you've got enemies chasing you around. Some of them take one hit, some of them take 10. And the hitboxes are indescribable.
Indescribable.
Sometimes an enemy will have a hitbox, which is great. But I think a lot of the frustration comes from not knowing what the heck is going on. There's no... And as much as we've talked about tutorials before and the necessary means of getting into a game, this one would have benefited from press the first button to attack. Press the second button to do everything else in the game. And I'm not kidding by any means of the imagination there. The second button uses items, goes through doors, and opens the menu, depending on where Zelda is stood.
Wow.
But, by the end of that first level, you walk into a cave, if you're lucky enough, and you fight a Dodongo. Now, if you've got any knowledge of The Legend of Zelda, you know that bombs beat Dodongos. In this game, no. 10 hits with the sword. A bomb would probably help, but at this point, you probably won't have bombs with you. So it makes me think, why did they choose a Dodongo? Is this to put off Zelda fans, you know, to confuse those of us that had played Zelda, The Legend of Zelda on the NES, you know, where the only way to beat the Dodongo is to feed it bombs? In this case, no, you can just stab it 10 times. And that really, really put me off right from the start. I thought, what am I playing here? Is this really is a roaring dumpster fire. But I'll tell you something, the more I played of it, I had fun.
Wow. Let it be known.
Or I had something that equates to fun. You start collecting rubies, not rupees in this one. It's rubies with a B. And then you go shopping. Then you get your items, the ropes and the bombs and the lantern fuel. So you got the lantern fuel that illuminates dark areas. You've got the bombs that can blow up entrances to caves. Sometimes they take one bomb. Sometimes they take 10. It depends on the level. And then you start getting other items. And these are used against specific bosses. And I'm starting to think, this is actually a decent game buried in this. It's just a matter of finding it. And for me, I think finding it was playing it with a walkthrough open next to me, I have to admit.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what I did with most of Zelda 2. It's just... It's the era, you just don't have the time anymore to be able to sit and brute force your way.
Yeah, that's what I say about the Simon's Quest redacted version. If it had made itself a bit more clear with some of its clues, yeah, I probably would have been able to do it myself. But with a walkthrough open, I know to go to this area next, I know to go to this area next. I didn't look at what to do in those areas, I just needed a kind of roadmap. But with that, I actually found myself having fun with this game. And so, yeah, it does have redeeming qualities. It's in some ways it kind of plays like if Zelda and a point and click adventure in a way kind of crossed over. You know, use this item at this place, use this item at this place, use this item to one shot this boss. And there are little parts of it that, dare I say, are good.
That's fascinating. So it sounds like at one point they had a good idea. And maybe it was execution of it. Listening to you talk about mechanics, it seems like there's a poor relationship between the visuals and the gameplay itself. In terms of, you mentioned not being able to kind of figure out how far you need to jump or what a platform is or in hitboxes. And that, I think, has to do with the graphics not being able to inform the player. Often when we talk about graphics, we just refer to the aesthetics. I mean, we as a society, as a civilization, rather. But graphics have utility. They need to have utility. They need to be able to inform the player constantly. I mean, if you can't tell the difference between a Goomba and a mushroom, a super mushroom, then that's a graphics problem, right? Because you don't want to bump into what you think is a super mushroom and you're like, oh darn it, it was a Goomba, but they look almost exactly alike. So that's why visual distinction needs to be key. And visual distinction with what is platform and what is background, what is enemy and what is empty air, needs to be something that's very carefully designed, and that's a visual question. So I think when you're grading visuals, it cannot just be, well, cannot. I always use these very strong terms, but they're black and white. In my view of critiquing games, if you're going to consider criticizing a game's graphics, then it's maybe a good idea to consider not just the aesthetics, but also how the visuals themselves function. Because remember, games are math. They're problems and problem solvings. They're coding. So they either function or they don't. All this, I get it out of my system. All this wishy-waffy, everything is subjective nonsense is just that. If everything is subjective, then the Wand of Gamelon is as good as A Link to the Past. And that makes no sense at all. It's a nonsense. It's a nonsense statement. Because one is better designed than the other in terms of craft, in terms of function, in terms of architecture, in terms of things like the information that the game gives you through its visuals. So hopefully that little spiel converted somebody.
Yeah, I think if you're going to compare it to anything at that time, I think the one thing that sprung to mind for me while I was playing it was the Super Nintendo version of Space Ace.
Which I despise.
Great Don Bluth game.
Yeah,
but the SNES version, which one of those is a platform and which one will send you to a pitfall of death?
Yes.
That's the kind of thing I was getting from Wand of Gamelon.
Very, very, very good mention there. I remember renting that for the weekend once and not being able to play it because their jumping mechanics are strange. I think you would jump and you couldn't change direction, which is a more realistic thing, I guess, in real life. If you jump in a direction, you can't suddenly change in midair. But it's not something that we were either accustomed to in video game jumping or is all that fun, it turns out, in video games. Especially in a game where once you jump, you have to commit to it, and there might not be a platform there where you think there might be a platform there because the background is just highly animated. So
you could be talking about Space Ace there. You could be talking about Wand of Gamelon.
So, and that's a visual issue. So moving on here, this is a question from Retro Game Brews. I actually think Zelda's Adventure is the worst of the three CDI Zelda games. So there you go, TB. Maybe you'll have a lot more fun with Faces of Evil. But my question is, which of the mechanics in Wand of Gamelon is most frustrating? Only having two buttons, the gratuitous use of darkness, the random NPCs you keep inadvertently engaging during battle. What is the most frustrating mechanic, in your opinion?
A lot of that was frustrating, and the random NPCs, definitely. You walk through a door, you're walking across to the other side of the room, suddenly there's a guy spawns behind you. It's like, where did you come from? overuse of darkness was that one. Yeah, every other room you walk into, you need to go into the menu, select the lantern, press the button to use the lantern, and then about 10 seconds later, you've got to do it all again because it goes dark.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was frustrating. Even in some outdoor levels, that was popping up from time to time.
Wow.
But I think the most frustrating thing for me was, aside from playing the game of guess what a platform is, the only having two buttons was very, very difficult. Like I said, you've got your button that uses the sword for the stab, which doubles up as speak to this character as well. In order to talk to one of the NPCs, you have to stab them.
What?
Yep.
That is but, odd.
It really is. But the most frustrating part for me was that the second button doubled up, like I said earlier, as use item, go through door, and also if you crouch and use the second button, open the menu. So you could be stood in front of a door and you'd crouch and press the second button to open the menu, go through the door. It's like, no, I didn't want you to go through the door. I wanted to, yeah.
Wow. It
really, really wound me up.
Wow. This thing needed more buttons. That's odd. That's just weird.
And yeah, that's all it needed. Just a couple more buttons.
So let's mention those visuals again, and the memery of the visuals. These cutscenes, I was surprised to learn, cutscenes were created by Russian animators, which is pretty amazing considering this was, you know, late 80s, the beginning of the 90s, Russian American relations weren't at their highest at the time. And apparently the games marked the first time that Russian outsourcing had been utilized by an American company. So there's a huge historical first. But looking at the visuals, there's a couple animated films that I was really reminded of now that I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, kind of showing them a lot of the animated films that I watched as a child. Some of them are still enjoyable, some of them not so much so. But one that we've seen a couple times now that is a moderate favorite is Raggedy Ann and Andy, A Musical Adventure. I don't know if you've ever seen that yourself.
It's not one that rings any bells for me.
All right. So one of the interesting things about this as an animated film, it used live action and animation throughout, but different scenes and different characters had different animators. So animators were in charge of specific characters. This is something that, you know, was done in later animated films, but with much more of an emphasis of cohesion. In this film, there's a huge difference between the animation in two scenes that are back-to-back, or there's even a tremendous difference between how one character is animated and another character is animated. And if you think you've got all of these, like, master animators animating, like, a dozen and a half characters on screen at once, it's absolutely chaotic. There's all kinds of weird stretching and physics that are happening, but some people's interpretation of physics are different than others. So you've got this weird kind of anti-gravity, somewhat nightmarish kind of animation that I've referred to as over animation it's over animated. There's too much happening at once. Something that was kind of resolved in early anime, at least, where, you know, a character would stand and talk and just their mouths would move and there'd be little animation in that regard. Or you think about the Hanna-Barbera cartoons that would do the same thing, just have kind of recycled stock character animations that you'd see over and over again. So then it's jarring to see something like this Raggedy Ann and Andy Musical Adventure. And I commend you to watch it sometime. It is a horrifying piece of animated history. There's a scene where the protagonists fall into this pit that's full of candy. And they encounter this being called the Greedy that's presumably made of candy, but always hungry. And the animators went nuts with the animation. They just went insane. It's like this shape-shifting candy monster. that never once looks the same as it did before. And it's just, it's a transformative monstrosity. So
this sounds incredible.
Yeah. Like I blew this film way out of the way too, too big of proportions. You're going to watch it and be like, this kind of sucks. I mean, I'm saying it's not like an amazing film, but when I was a kid, I wanted to be an animator, and there's a part of me that still loves illustration. And so I watched something like that, and I just appreciate the level of detail, even though the execution in the final presentation isn't the most visually appealing thing. But there are a bunch of animated films that kind of fall into that. So anyway, your thoughts on the visuals and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you mentioned in the Russian animators there. If I could just pause for a moment to give a shout out to one of the Russian animators that worked on this, who has the greatest name ever, Igor Razbov.
Igor Razbov. That's
such a cool name. Yeah, that's brilliant. Looking at the animation that's there, things just move constantly. There's never any downtime for these characters, and like you said, over animating everything that doesn't need animating at times. That's definitely the case. And there's so much going on, and so much, so many colors as well. Like I say, it's not surprising I was overawed by this when I first saw it playing on a demo reel in the shop. Especially, like I say, if I can make that comparison again to Space Ace, looking at the back of the Super Nintendo box and seeing those amazing screenshots with the Don Bluth characters and thinking, wow, my SNES can do that. And looking at this and thinking, wow, a console can do that. And then you get into the game and like, oh, okay, right, I get it. But yeah, wow. In terms of what they actually put out with the cutscenes that they created here, the animation, yeah, at the time it looked fantastic. Very toothy, but fantastic. Again, the way in which it's been appropriated for, like you said, meme culture. King Harkinian is just... he's just wonderful, isn't he?
He's an endless resource of memes, yeah.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah, the laughing sequence with him, he's got his arm around Zelda, I think it is. Is just it's so popular and rightfully so. It looks so strange.
Yeah, there's so many that pop up at points in the game you wouldn't expect as well. You walk into the church in the village Sakado, and you're just expecting the next level to pop up, and you get this animated sequence with one of the mummies. Was it Gibdo, the mummy character, talking to camera? And it startled me when it first came up. Whoa, who's this guy? again, when you throw one of... because all the bosses in this game are one-hit kills if you've got the right item. Otherwise, they're invincible. You throw the shroud at the mummy boss, and it, again, seamlessly from the game to the animated cutscene, and you've got another wonderful piece where it goes, "The shroud!"
I did see fantastic. That one.
Yeah. Did you see the best one, though? Later on in the game where you fight against Hectan, wizard boss, he kind of melts when you use the right item on him. And it goes into the animated cutscene where he goes, "You've killed me!" At which point Zelda goes, "Good! Good? Really? That's your reaction?"
There's a guy with like lips for his head.
Oh, the lips for head guy. That guy was just whoever created. I've got the name of that thing here somewhere. Ormfac. I've literally put down in my notes, Ormfac, complete weirdo, lips for head. And underneath I've put the part where I've actually beaten Ormfac. I've put in capital letters, "His lips exploded into birds."
It's like a psychedelic like 1970s like music video or something.
Oh, what are you working on there? Oh, just lips exploding into birds. You do your thing.
one of the strangest things about the animation, I think, is how when somebody is talking with you, the character's face approaches the screen closer and closer and closer until their head fills up the entire screen. And that's just really uncomfortable. I mean, imagine if you were talking with someone and they just kept putting their face like closer and closer to your face. Talk about faces of evil, man. Like that. Yeah. Just uncomfortable.
I'm going to do that this week just for a laugh.
Yeah. You're talking to somebody like, and that's how you get restraining orders. Well, here's a, here are some final audience comments and questions. Okay. This is from Srick 360. As horrible as it was, I would love to see a new side-scrolling Zelda game with a cool cartoon style. Zeldavania. That would actually be pretty neat. I would buy that.
I would buy that. Yeah. I mean, Zelda and Castlevania, two of my favorites of all time. Yeah.
There you go.
If it was something that played like Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, wonderful.
Yeah, and the cool thing about the Zelda series is it kind of reinvents itself again and again and again, you know?
Yeah.
Breath of the Wild had a lot of traditional similarities, but it also took a lot of different turns and did different things. And I don't think that we'll see for the next 10 years a bunch of Breath of the Wilds. I think we'll see, you know, a continued evolution of this series. And trying new things is wonderful for a series to do. Here's a question from Eros Elric. Glad someone gets to do CDI Games Red. Yes, Eros Elric, who was on the previous podcast with you, and we discussed Shadow Hearts, right?
Yes.
Yes. his question was, do you think the American Legend of Zelda cartoon had some bearing on the characterization of Link? If so, how? And does this game prove that Link should remain a silent protagonist? Your thoughts?
When I was playing this game recently, I sent a text to my girlfriend saying, oh, I'm playing the Bad Zelda games today. She sent back, if I can just read this, the Bad Zeldas are funny AF. They are the main argument for Link not being able to talk.
There you go.
To answer your question, Eros, my girlfriend says yes. when you've got the little animated sequences where you've got Link at the very start of Wand of Gamelon saying something like, oh boy, can't wait to bomb some Dodongos. I think, yes, that's definitely influenced by Excuse Me, Princess, from the animated cartoon. There's definitely something there that they've taken on board.
Yeah, I think I would agree. And it makes sense given the time between them. Link just kind of loses all of the, I don't want to say mystique, maybe dignity when he's portrayed as talking. Dignity is kind of a funny term to use when the character says, yeah, and that sort of thing constantly. But take like the Link in Breath of the Wild. It's kind of remarkable at how many cutscenes are in Breath of the Wild, yet Link says nothing. It's still possible to sustain a game then on a silent protagonist with some elements of story. It's not like Breath of the Wild was super story heavy anyway. But I think that Link as sort of the silent swordsman is an interesting thing and something that makes him unique too. So I appreciate it. Here's a question from Bill Tucker TSP, who said, do you think this would have fared better as a traditional SNES or N64 title, or was it doomed from conception?
Considering where it came from and the developers just having the use of the characters, not necessarily the IP attached to it. Mm-hmm. What I did read earlier when I was looking up on this said that the only confirmation that they got from Nintendo was the art style of the characters. Everything else in the game, they just said, yeah, do whatever, from what I understand. If this had been on the Super Nintendo, maybe it would have been a completely different game. Maybe it would have been something. Maybe it would have been like Space Ace. Maybe it could have been made something. I always say make to the platform, because that's something I've got a lot of contention with VR at the moment. There's a lot of games being shoehorned into VR that don't really fit with it. Build a game from the ground up. Don't shoehorn an existing game into a new platform. Maybe. I would have loved to have seen this on the Super Nintendo with actual platforms.
So, a couple of thoughts I have on that is I don't think that merely going to the Super Nintendo or the N64 would have saved it, because there were bad games on the Super Nintendo and on the N64.
If they'd have had that technology available to them rather than being told by Philips, show off what we can do.
Maybe
they would have been able to make something to that hardware. That's what I was trying to say there.
Oh, yes. And I completely agree with that. And I to echo something that you said as well about it potentially being even a different game entirely had it appeared on, let's say, the Super Nintendo. The Super Nintendo could not have supported the seamless use of all those cutscenes with voice acting.
No.
It just couldn't. There wasn't enough space. Bearing in mind that this is a CD-ROM game. So a lot of what Wand of Gamelon is would have had to have been cut or interpreted differently on the Super Nintendo. Yeah. So maybe the N64, but I don't know. I mean, there were still cartridges. So, and then there's the whole thing.
That's why Final Fantasy went over to PlayStation.
Exactly. Yeah. It was going to take dozens of cartridges to fit Final Fantasy VII. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that... Yeah. If you say, you know, Wand of Gamelon, put it on SNES or N64, it just would have been a different game. And at that point, it kind of sucks the question dry, right? It's no longer the same game, so we're just talking about a hypothetical concept.
Yeah.
So was it Dune from conception? I think that they had things going against them, such as the low budget for producing two games, the fairly short amount of time that they had to produce two games in, the Philips CDI hardware, which didn't have a ton of success going for it. And then trying a bunch of new things with only a handful of, I think it was, what, five characters that they were allowed? One of them being Mario, who doesn't even appear in this game anyway. So,
I think that's your quota of characters that you've hit that Philips were allowed to use. I think it might have been Link, Zelda, Mario, Luigi, and Bowser, and those three were used in Hotel Mario.
Well, you mentioned Ganon. Is Bowser in Hotel Mario?
I think it was in a cutscene.
Oh,
I'm not entirely
maybe
sure.
Maybe it must have been six then, because they used Ganon.
Maybe.
In Wand of Gamelon. We got to go change Wikipedia. Don't know. Have you played Hotel
Let's just
Mario?
Go back and change history.
Yeah, right.
Funnily enough, I'm playing Hotel Mario for the Super Mario Multiverse that we're doing.
So, which is coming out on March 10th, 2020, this year.
That's the one.
Yep. So, keep an eye out, folks, if you want to hear more about CDIs from TB. He's going to be talking about Hotel Mario quite soon. But we've got a final set of statements here. And this kind of, I think, concludes the thoughts that we've had from Bill's question just now. But this is from Umbral Ice, who said, I personally liked Zelda 2 and thought more games like it wouldn't have been bad. These games, the CDI games, I feel, had they been developed by Nintendo and didn't have the horrible animations, voice acting, and more polished gameplay, could have been interesting, perhaps even good Zelda games. While the time for these games have passed, a properly done Zelda by Nintendo that could in many more creative ways introduce and utilize the fire snowball mechanic of Faces of Evil, or a proper game playing as Zelda, more magic than sword, I'd assume, would be great. I think that kind of touches on the things that, if you're going to put it on the Super Nintendo or the N64, it needs that Nintendo polish. It shows that this was not developed by Nintendo.
Definitely. And I think if you think about the ways that the Zelda games have gone from the 2D to the 3D, and, you know, even now there's a lot of love
for the top-down Zelda games. Just look at the success of Link's Awakening on Switch. Mm-hmm. That has been absolutely mm-hmm. wonderful to see. And yeah. maybe if they could make a game in the Wand of Gamelon Faces of Evil style, maybe that could be Nintendo's or The Legend of Zelda's return to 2D platform Zelda that we saw on the NES in The Adventure of Link. Heck, if they did it, it could be the series answer to Symphony of the Night.
Mm, there you go. Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for the consistent quality of the Zelda games. You kind of meet yeah. a lot of fans who have their favorite Zeldas and maybe Zeldas that they don't think too highly of. But I usually find that that comes down to fan expectation because,
yeah.
you know, so-and-so isn't like such and such. I don't like it or I don't think it's a Zelda game. But I think that freedom for Zelda as a series to be able to try new things and tell stories in different ways and play around with gameplay while still being traditional and tied to the core of Zelda is something that makes this series really interesting and really great. Doesn't mean I love every Zelda that I play. I don't, but I think that they're all Zeldas in their own right, except for these, which of course are not official anyway. So, but if Nintendo, well, you remember they showed off that bit of Breath of the Wild sequel clip last year, I think it was.
Yeah.
Imagine if that comes out and they're like, oh, and by the way, it's a side-scrolling platformer. I'd be like, hey, that's interesting. I'm sure it would ruffle some feathers, but I don't think that alone would mean it would be a poor quality game. I think that Nintendo has a pretty dang good history of making quality games with their core IPs. So yeah. It'd be something to look forward to. But
I'd like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And let's conclude on that. Just make more Zeldas, please.
Yes.
But, sir, where can our listeners find you?
You can find my writing at the Well-Read Mage. I am the regional exclusive mage, and I know a lot about games that came out in Europe but not America, or America but not Europe, or sometimes even the Japanese ones. And if you want to listen to more of my incessant rambling, you can find me on Twitter at TeachableOak85.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining me for this very first episode of MageCast Season 2. I appreciate it. I think that starting the year off with Wand of Gamelon was just the best possible choice.
It's been great. Thank you, Evans, so much for having me.
Thank you for being here for the launch of MageCast Season 2. I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Visit thewellreadmage.com for more magical mageliness. And you can also check out patreon.com/thewellreadmage if you would like to help support this show. This episode may be over, but the legend will live on, passed down by the dwarves, the elves, and the dragons.